A flurry of voices rose, telling Tauntaun to shut up. Our mamas and papas aren't bad, just unlucky, the boy went on in his relentless way. And Matt isn't bad either.
Oh, go to bed, said Jorge. Do you think anyone wants to listen to your ravings? You've always been stupid, and you'll always be stupid. You're lucky I pulled you out of dreamland before I found out what an idiot you are.
I'm not stupid, cried Tauntaun, but no one listened to him. The boys drew away from Matt as though he were something unclean. The keepers hurried him and Chacho out, and Carlos bolted the door behind them. They were taken to a small closet without enough space to lie down. It was dark and airless. The floor was cold. All night the boys huddled against the wall, and Matt was glad it was dark and that they had their mouths covered with tape. He couldn't have borne hearing Chacho call him a crot, or seeing him shrink away from the presence of such a monster. Chapter 33. The Boneyard. A faint light shone under the door when two of the younger keepers arrived to fetch Matt and Chacho. Matt was so stiff, he fell over when they pulled him to his feet. Came from behind the tape covering Chacho's mouth. They were urged outside to one of the carts the keepers used to move equipment around the factory. Jorge was in the driver's seat, smoking a cigarette. More tape was wound around the boy's ankles. The cart rolled slowly at first, because it was solar-powered. But as the sun rose higher and flooded the salt flats, it picked up speed. Matt saw the shrimp tanks move past. He realized they were heading toward the western fence. The cart's wheels crunched along the gritty path, and sand hissed across the ground in an early morning breeze. Matt was thirsty. He was hungry, too. He saw, with a kind of bitter pleasure, that Jorge's shoulder was encased in a plaster cast. Matt hoped he was in a lot of pain. After a while, the cart turned and bumped along rougher ground. Matt saw they were driving parallel to the fence. He saw a white swirl of seagulls as they rose and sank along the Gulf of California. Their cries floated to him on the dusty wind. On and on the cart struggled. When it floundered in sand, the men had to jump out and put creosote bushes under the wheels to urge it on. At last it jerked to a stop, and Matt was carried off by the two young keepers. They came over a rise. Before them stretched the wide basin that had once been full of living water and was now filled with dead whales. The bones stuck up like a gigantic bowl of thorns.
This is what we call the boneyard, Jorge said pleasantly.
Matt remembered someone saying when he first arrived, You won't get away with your swanky ways here. We've got something called the boneyard, and any troublemaker who goes through it comes out as harmless as a little lamb.
Shall I take the tape off now? One of the keepers inquired.
Only from his mouth, said Jorge.
But that means he won't be able to climb out.
He tried to kill me, Jorge shouted. Did you want a murderer crawling back to stir up revolution?
Carlos won't like it.
You leave Carlos to me, said Jorge.
Matt felt the tape rip off. He flexed his mouth, ran his tongue over his bruised lips.
You think you're thirsty now, Jorge said, smiling.
Wait till tomorrow.
He's the murderer, cried Matt, but he had no time to say anything else. The men swung him up and out. He came down with a crash, and the bones shifted and let him fall through. Down he tumbled, rolling this way and that, until he arrived at a plateau of skulls. He hung in the midst of a sea of bones, with the blue sky visible through a fretwork of ribs and vertebrae. He turned his head cautiously. Below was a pit whose dark depths he could only guess at. A few minutes later, he heard Chacho land not far away. The mass shifted again, and Matt slipped down a few more feet. He felt a rib poke into his back. A fine dust of salt and sand pattered over his face. He heard Chacho cough. He heard the men's feet crunch away, and then the purr of the cart growing fainter and fainter until it was gone.
Are you okay? called Chacho. Depends on what you mean by okay.
Matt was amazed he could still laugh, although he did it weakly. Are you hurt?
Not much. Got any good escape plans?
I'm working on it, said Matt. The salt powdered his face and got into his mouth.
I wouldn't mind a drink.
Don't talk about it, said Chacho.
I think I could cut this tape if I could find a sharp bone.
There's one sticking into my back, said Matt. He spoke cheerfully, as though they were working on a way to snatch an extra 10 minutes of sleep, not trying to escape a long, painful death.
Some people have all the luck.
Chacho spoke lightly, too, but Matt suspected he was just as frightened.
Matt wriggled until his wrists touched the jagged bone. He sawed back and forth. But before he could make any progress, the bones shifted, and he slid down into deeper darkness.
Matt!
Cried Chacho with an edge of panic.
I'm here! Well, that didn't work. Why don't you give it a try?
In fact, Matt's heart was pounding, and he was afraid to move. The whole basin quivered, and he didn't know what would happen if he fell all the way to the bottom.
Heck! Ah, heck!
Shouted Chacho.
Matt heard him slither through the fretwork of bones.
We've got all day. You don't have to hurry, said Matt. Shut up! I think there's something else in this pit!
Matt thought he heard a high-pitched noise. Was it possible something lived in the darkness below? And what kind of creature would choose such a home?
They're bats! Horrible, slimy bats! Yelled Chacho.
Bats aren't slimy, Matt said, relieved. A real creature was much better than the monsters he'd imagined.
Stop making jokes! They'll suck our blood!
No, they won't, said Matt. Tamlin and I watched them dozens of times.
They'll wait for dark. I saw it in a movie. They'll wait for dark, and then they'll come up and suck our blood.
Chacho's panic was shrill and infectious. Matt began to get scared, too.
Tamlin says they're just mice with wings. They're as afraid of us as we are of...
One's coming at me! Screamed Chacho. Keep still! Don't move! Yelled Matt.
A horrible idea had just occurred to him, and he had to warn Chacho before anything else happened. Chacho kept screaming, but he must have heard Matt's advice, because he didn't struggle. After a moment, his cries stopped and were replaced by sobbing.
Chacho, called Matt.
The boy didn't answer. He wept on and on, hiccuping to catch his breath.
Matt turned carefully, searching for another sharp bone. Below, in the ghostly near blackness, tiny bats fluttered and squeaked. They must have found the pit almost as comfortable as a cave. They flitted here and there, navigating between the bones like fish in a sea. A sour smell, disturbed by their wings, filtered up.
Chacho, Matt called. I'm here. The bats are settling down. I'm gonna try to cut the tape again.
We'll never get out, groaned Chacho.
Sure we will, Matt said. But we have to be very, very careful. We mustn't fall down any farther.
We're going to die, said Chacho. If we try to climb out, the bones will shift. There's tons of them here. We'll fall to the bottom and they'll come down on top of us.
Matt said nothing. That was exactly the thought he'd had. For a few moments he was swept with despair, unable to think clearly. Was this the end to the chance at life he'd been given by Tamlin and Celia? They'd never know what had happened to him. They'd think he had deserted them.
Tamlin says rabbits give up when they're caught by coyotes, Matt said,
after he'd calmed enough to trust his voice.
He says they consent to die, because they're animals and can't understand hope. But humans are different. They fight against death no matter how bad things seem. And sometimes, even when everything's against them, they win.
Yeah, about once in a million years, said Chacho.
Twice in a million, said Matt. There's two of us.
You are one dumb bunny, said Chacho.
but he stopped crying. As the sun slowly worked its way across the sky, Matt became more and more thirsty. He tried not to think about it, but he couldn't help it. His tongue was glued to his mouth. His throat was gritty with sand.
"I found a sharp bone," said Chacho. "I think it's a tooth."
"Great," said Matt, who was working his bonds against a rib. The tape had an amazing ability to stretch. He sawed and sawed, and the tape merely lengthened and didn't break. But after a while, it became loose enough for Matt to slip his hands free.
"I did it," he called.
"Me too,"
said Chacho.
"I'm working on my feet."
For the first time, Matt felt real hope. He drew his legs up carefully and picked at the bonds with a fragment of bone. It was horribly exhausting. He had to move extremely slowly to keep from sliding deeper. And he had to stop and rest every other minute. He realized he was growing weak. Chacho seemed to rest for longer periods, too.
"Who's Tamlin?"
he asked during one of these breaks. "My father," said Matt. This time, he didn't stumble over the words.
"That's funny, calling your parents by name."
"It's what they wanted." There was a long pause. Chacho said,
"Are you really a zombie?"
"No," said Matt.
"Do you think I could talk like this if I were?" "But you've seen them."
"Yes," said Matt. The wind had died down and the air felt heavy and still. The silence was eerie, because it felt like the desert was waiting for something to happen. Even the bats had stopped chittering.
"Tell me about zombies," said Chacho.
So Matt described the brown-clad men and women who toiled endlessly over the fields and the gardeners who clipped the vast lawns of El Patron's estate with scissors. "We call them Ejits," he said.
"It sounds like you were there a long time,"
said Chacho. "All my life," said Matt, deciding, for once, to be honest.
"Were your parents Ejits?"
"I guess you could call them slaves. A lot of work has to be done by people with normal intelligence." Chacho sighed.
"So, my father could be okay. He was a musician. Did you have musicians there?"
"Yes," said Matt, thinking of Mr. Ortega. But Mr. Ortega couldn't have been Chacho's father. He'd been around too long. The sun was low in the west now. It was darker than Matt expected for this time of day, even with the light cut down by the pit. The breeze picked up again. It moaned like a lost spirit in the bones and turned surprisingly cold.
"It sounds like La Llorona," said Chacho.
"That's just a story," said Matt.
"My mother used to tell me about her, and my mother didn't lie."
Chacho reacted instantly to any real or imagined insult to his mother. Matt knew she'd died when Chacho was 6. "Okay, I'll believe in La Llorona if you'll believe the bats aren't dangerous."
"I wish you hadn't brought them up," said Chacho.
The wind blew even harder, sending a swirl of dust over the basin. The topmost bones rattled, and all at once, Matt saw a blinding flash of light, followed by a crack of thunder.
"It's a storm," he said in wonder.
The chill wind pushed the smell of rain at him, making his thirst even more unbearable. Desert storms were rare, except in August and September, but they weren't unheard of. They blew up suddenly, wreaked havoc, and vanished almost as quickly as they'd come. This one promised to be spectacular. The sky turned white, and then peach-colored in the sunset light as a giant cloud loomed overhead. Lightning forked. Matt counted from flash to thunder to gauge how far away it was. 1 mile. 1/2 mile. 1/4. And then, right on top of them, the bottom of the cloud opened, pouring out hailstones as big as cherries.
"Catch them!"
shouted Matt, but the roar of the storm was so loud Chacho probably couldn't hear. Matt caught them as they skittered down through the bones and crammed them into his mouth. They were followed by rain, buckets and buckets of rain. Matt opened his mouth and let it pour in. In the flashes of light, he saw bats clinging to the bones. He heard water rushing over the side of the basin. And then it was gone. The thunder retreated across the desert. The lightning grew fainter. but water still poured into the pit. Matt bunched up his shirt and sucked out as much moisture as he could. The rain had revived him, but he hadn't gotten nearly as much water as he wanted. The sky was almost dark now.
"Aim yourself at the nearest edge while you can still see," Matt called to Chacho. "My legs are free. Are yours?"
The boy didn't answer.
"Are you okay?"
Matt had the awful thought that Chacho had slipped to the bottom during the violent storm.
"Chacho, answer me!"
"The bats," said the boy, in a hollow voice.
He was still nearby. Matt felt a rush of relief.
"They won't hurt you," he said.
"They're all over me," said Chacho, in that odd voice.
"Me too."
Matt suddenly became aware of the little creatures creeping onto his body.
They're trying to get away from the water, he stammered, hoping it was true. "Their nesting place is flooded, and I guess they want to get warm."
"They're waiting for it to be dark," Chacho said. "And then they'll drink our blood."
"Don't be a complete idiot," shouted Matt. "They're frightened and they're cold."
All the same, he felt an instinctive horror at their stealthy movements. A distant flash of lightning showed him a tiny creature huddled against his chest. It had a flat nose and leaf-like ears, and its mouth disclosed delicate, needle-sharp teeth. But it also had a baby tucked under one leathery wing. It was a mother trying to rescue her young from the flood.
"You wouldn't bite me, would you?"
he whispered to the mother bat. He turned slowly, freezing in place when the bones threatened to shift, then moving again, aiming toward where he thought the nearest edge lay. The bat clung briefly to his shirt before sliding off into the darkness. It was like being a swimmer in a strange and terrible sea. Every time Matt moved forward, he sank down a little. At one point, the bones weighed upon his back and he feared they had trapped him, but they shifted slightly and allowed him to move on. Yet every stroke toward shore increased their weight. Soon he would be unable to move, and then he would have to wait, like a bug imprisoned in amber, for death to find him. The pit was completely black when his hand struck against rock instead of bone. Matt grasped the wall and inched himself upward until he was able to plant his feet against the stone. Now the bones seemed even heavier, but that was because he was trying to force his way up through them. He leaned against the rock, panting with exhaustion. He found a trickle of storm water still flowing and lapped it like a dog. It was cold and mineral. It tasted wonderful.
"Chacho," he called. "If you come toward my voice, you'll reach the edge. There's water."
But the boy didn't answer.
"I'll keep talking, so you'll know where to go," said Matt.
He talked about his childhood, leaving out things that would be hard to explain. He described Celia's apartment and his trips into the mountains with Tamlin. He described the Egypt pens and the opium fields that surrounded them. Matt didn't know whether Chacho could hear him. The boy might have fainted, or the bats really might have drunk his blood. It was the middle of the night when Matt pulled himself over the edge and collapsed onto wet earth. He was unable to move. All the willpower he'd used to work his way free deserted him. He lay on his side with his face half in mud. He couldn't have moved if Jorge had shown up with an army of keepers. As he drifted in and out of consciousness, he heard a strange sound coming from the pit. Matt listened, trying to decide what animal made such a noise. And then it came to him.
Chacho was snoring.
The boy had fallen asleep from sheer exhaustion. He might still be trapped in the pit, but he was alive. And the bats hadn't drunk his blood after all. Chapter 34. The Shrimp Harvester. The sky was dark blue and the mud bore a powdering of frost when Matt pulled himself from the ground. He crouched to protect what little warmth his body produced. A wind ruffled the little pools of water that dotted the desert. The east was a blaze of pink and yellow. Matt had never been so cold in his life, His teeth chattered. His body felt like one giant goosebump. In the growing light, he saw that his clothes had been torn in a dozen places during his journey through the pit. His arms and legs were covered with scratches. He hadn't noticed the injuries during the desperate fight to survive, but now he hurt all over.
Chacho,
he called to the sea of bones turning gray in the pre-dawn light.
Chacho!
Matt's voice was carried off by the breeze.
I'm outside. I'm safe. You can be too. Just come toward my voice.
No answer.
You'll go down a little, but after a while you'll come to the edge of the pit. I can help you then,
called Matt. No answer. Matt paced back and forth along the edge of the basin. He had a fair idea where Chacho was, but he couldn't see him.
There's water out here from the storm. I can't get it to you, but you can come to it. It'll make you feel a lot better. Please, Chacho, don't give up.
But the boy made no reply. Matt found a rain-filled hollow in a rock and drank until his head stabbed with pain. The water was freezingly cold. He went back to the edge of the basin, calling, begging, and even insulting Chacho to get a response. There was nothing. As the sun came over the rim of the desert, and light flooded the little hillocks and bushes all around, Matt curled up in the shelter of a rock and cried. He couldn't think of a thing to do. Chacho was out there, but he couldn't find him. Even if he did find him, Matt couldn't go to him, and there weren't any plants in the desert that would make a decent rope. Matt wept until he was exhausted, which didn't take long because he was already tired. The sunlight brought a slight warmth to the air, although the wind whipped it away the minute Matt stood up. What could he do? Where could he go? He couldn't stay here until Jorge came back to check up on things. But he couldn't leave Chacho behind, either. He limped back to the basin and sat on the edge. He talked and talked, sometimes exhorting Chacho to come towards his voice, sometimes only rambling on about his childhood. He talked about El Patrón and the fantastic birthday parties. He talked about María and Furball. He talked until his throat was raw. But he didn't stop, because he felt this was the only rope he could throw Chacho. If Chacho could hear him, he wouldn't feel completely alone, and he might try to stay alive. The sun rose high enough to shine into the pit. Matt saw, not far down, a patch of brown. It was the uniform all the boys wore in the factory.
I can see you, Chacho, said Matt. You aren't far from the edge. You can make it if you try.
In the distance he heard a clanking mechanical noise. It wasn't Jorge's cart, but perhaps the keeper had borrowed something sturdier. Matt shaded his eyes. He wanted to hide, but he saw with dismay that he'd left muddy footprints all over the ground. He couldn't possibly wipe them out before someone arrived. He waited hopelessly for the keeper to find him. But instead, to his amazement, he saw Tom's shrimp harvester shuddering and groaning over the desert. Fidelito sat on the hood. As soon as he saw Matt, he jumped off and started running.
Matt! Matt! Shrieked the little boy. You got out! Where's Chacho?
He flung himself at Matt and almost knocked him over.
I'm so happy you're alive. I was so worried.
Matt held on to him, to keep him from dancing over the edge of the basin. The shrimp harvester jerked to a stop.
I thought you might need help, said Tonton.
Matt began to laugh, only it wasn't a laugh, more like hysteria.
Need help? He wheezed. I guess you could say that.
I did say it,
said Tonton, looking puzzled. Matt began to shiver. His laughter turned into stormy weeping.
Don't do that,
wailed Fidelito.
It's Chacho, sobbed Matt. He's in the bones. He won't talk. I think he's dead.
Where?
Said Tonton. Matt pointed out the brown uniform, all the while clutching Fidelito's arm. He was terrified the little boy would fall into the pit. Tonton positioned the harvester at the edge. He reached into the bones with the mechanical arm he used to tip shrimp tanks into his collecting bin. At the end was a large claw. Slowly, methodically, Tonton cleared away the top layer until they could see Chacho's face. The boy's eyes were closed. Tonton moved away more bones, until Chacho's chest appeared. The cloth was torn, and his uniform was streaked with blood. But he was breathing.
"It'd work better if he could, help,"
said Tonton. He maneuvered the machine as delicately as a surgeon performing an operation. "Could I climb out on the arm and tie a rope around him?" Matt had stopped crying, but he couldn't seem to stop shivering.
"Hm," grunted Tonton. "You'd be, as much help as a drunk buzzard trying to, carry off a dead cow."
He continued working so slowly and carefully that Matt wanted to scream. Yet, it made sense. Any wrong move could send the bone slithering back down to cover Chacho. Finally, Tonton closed the jaws of the shrimp harvester around Chacho's body. The jaws were strong enough to crush rock, but Tonton lifted the boy as gently as if he were an egg. He backed up the machine. The arm swung around until it cleared the basin and deposited Chacho on the ground. Tonton pulled the arm up and over the top of the shrimp harvester, folding it into the storage position. Careful in everything, he wasn't about to leave this job half done. Matt knelt by Chacho and felt his pulse. It was slow, but strong. Fidelito patted his face.
"Why won't he wake up?"
"He's, in shock," said Tonton, alighting from the machine. "I've seen it before. People can take only so much fear, and then they go into a kind of, sleep. Hold him up. I've got to get fluids into him."
Matt propped Chacho up while Tonton dribbled red liquid from a plastic bottle into the boy's mouth.
"It's strawberry soda," explained Tonton. "The keepers drink it all the time. It's got electrolytes in it. Good for dehydration."
Matt was surprised by Tonton's medical knowledge. But of course, he stored away everything he heard. Luna at the infirmary must have talked about dehydration. Chacho coughed, licked his lips, and swallowed. His eyes flew open. He grabbed the bottle and began gulping for all he was worth.
"Slow down," said Tonton, wrenching the bottle away. "If you drink too fast, you'll, puke."
"More, more,"
croaked Chacho, but Tonton forced him to take sips. Chacho said some bad words, but the older boy shrugged them off. He continued to dole out the strawberry soda until he was satisfied Chacho had had enough. He unpacked another bottle and gave it to Matt. "Heaven can't possibly be better than this," thought Matt, swirling the sweet, cool liquid around his mouth. The taste of strawberry soda had to be right up there with El Patrón's Moro crabs flown in from Yucatán.
"We'd better get going,"
said Tonton, firing up the shrimp harvester. Matt's euphoria came down with a thump. "Go back. Jorge wants to kill us. I heard him say so."
"Keep your hair on," said Tonton. "We're going to San Luis to find my abuelita."
"It was my idea," said Fidelito.
"It was my idea,"
Tonton said firmly. Matt held his hand over Fidelito's mouth to shush him. It didn't matter who thought of it, as long as Tonton didn't get sidetracked.
"I don't know how far I can walk," murmured Chacho. He looked dazed.
"That's why I brought the, shrimp harvester," said Tonton. "You and Matt can ride in the tank. Fidelito can, sit up front with me."
That, as far as Tonton was concerned, was the end of the discussion. Matt didn't argue. By some slow, careful process, Tonton had decided to make a break for it. And if he wanted to make a break at 5 miles an hour, nothing Matt said was going to talk him out of it. Matt wondered how he hoped to evade the keepers. Matt helped Chacho climb down a metal ladder into the tank. Even with the old water flushed out, it reeked of rotten shrimp. Matt thought he'd throw up, except he didn't have anything to throw up. At least he wouldn't get hungry on the way. Chacho fell asleep on the damp floor, but Matt climbed up the ladder and faced into the breeze.
5 miles an hour.
Matt saw he'd been wildly optimistic. Fidelito could have skipped faster than the shrimp harvester moved. Tonton had to maneuver around rocks and away from holes. Several times the machine threatened to tip over, but it ground on relentlessly and righted itself. They went north, around the vast basin of bones, and then west, The soil was littered with boulders, the spaces between with deep sand, where the harvester wallowed and complained before struggling on. Finally, they arrived at the fence, and Tonton halted.
"Everyone out," he announced.
He had to help Matt pull Chacho from the tank. Chacho was too weak to stand. With the Elito dancing attendants, they carried him to a soft patch of sand.
"Stay here," Tonton told Fidelito. "I mean it. If I catch you near the harvester, I'll beat the stuffing out of you."
"He wouldn't, really,"
whispered Fidelito as the older boy strode away. "What about the keepers?" Matt said. "Isn't he afraid they'll catch us?"
"Not a chance,"
Fidelito wriggled with excitement.
"They're locked up in their compound. The doors and windows are covered with bags of salt. Mountains and mountains of salt. All the boys helped."
"Didn't the keepers try to stop them?"
"They were asleep," Fidelito said. "Tonton said they wouldn't wake up, no matter how much noise we made."
Matt had a bad feeling about this, but he was too startled by what Tonton was doing now to ask more questions. The boy had clamped the jaws of the shrimp harvester onto a single wire in the fence. He backed up slowly, pulling the wire with a horrible, grinding, screeching noise until, snap, the wire parted. Tonton attacked another wire, and another. The more he broke, the easier it was to unthread the fence. And soon, he'd created a hole big enough to drive through. Matt watched the top of the fence anxiously. The one wire they had to worry about was still up there, snapping and humming in the breeze. As long as Tonton didn't disturb its insulation, they would be safe. "How do you feel?" Matt asked Chacho.
"I don't know," said the boy in a faint voice. "I'm not sure what's wrong. I tried to reach you last night, but the bones came down so hard I could hardly breathe. It was like being squeezed under a rock."
He paused, seeming too weak to go on. "Does your chest hurt?" said Matt. Now he understood why Chacho had never answered him.
"A bit, but I don't think I broke anything. It's just, I can't seem to get enough air."
"Don't talk," Matt said. "We'll take you to a doctor as soon as we get to San Luis." He was deeply worried, but he didn't understand what was wrong either. Tonton drove through the opening he'd created and helped Matt carry Chacho to the tank. The next part of the trip was much better. A road paralleled the fence, and the shrimp harvester was able to move much faster. Now and then, Tonton stopped to stretch his legs and to let Fidelito run off some of his energy.
"If you, jump up and down on my seat one more time, I'm going to, beat the stuffing out of you," he growled.
The little boy quieted down for a minute or two. All of them drank strawberry sodas. Tonton had a crate of them in the cab. He took a break for lunch, producing wonderful food the likes of which Chacho and Fidelito had never seen. They ate pepperoni sausages and cheese, bottled olives, and cream crackers. And if the food made them thirsty, it didn't matter, because they had more strawberry soda than they could drink. They finished with chocolates wrapped in gold paper.
"I'm so happy I could fly,"
Fidelito said with a contented sigh. Matt worried about the slow, leisurely trip they were taking. "Aren't you afraid the keepers will dig their way out?" he asked Tonton.
"I told him about the salt bags," said Fidelito.
They're asleep," said the older boy.
"Not after all this time," Matt said. "Unless... oh, Tonton, you didn't give them laudanum."
"They earned it,"
he said, in the same dogged way he'd defended them in the infirmary. "How much?"
"Enough,"
said Tonton. Matt could see he wasn't going to supply any more information.
"It was wonderful,"
Fidelito piped up.
"Tonton told us we were going to rescue you, only we had to wait for sunrise."
"The harvester works on, solar energy," said Tonton.
"So Flacco checked to be sure the keepers were really asleep. He and the others carried off their food, and then they piled as many bags of salt around the building as they could find. Flacco said he'd wait for the supply hovercraft to fly him to the keeper's
headquarters, said Tonton.
"Yes, and tell them what Jorge did."
"Flacco trusts headquarters. I don't," said Tonton.
"Me neither,"
murmured Chacho. He was propped against the side of the harvester with a bottle of soda. He seemed barely awake. "Maybe we should hurry," Matt said, looking at Chacho.
"Yes,"
Tantan agreed. And so the shrimp harvester ground on until it reached the corner where the fence turned right. The road continued north, toward a low range of hills. To the left lay the remnant of the Gulf of California, but presently it vanished and was replaced with drifting sand. Whiffs of foul-smelling air drifted over the harvester. It was the same smell Matt had met in the wastelands near the Egypt pens, only here it was sharper and more alarming. The sun was low in the west. Shadows began to lengthen across the desert. The shrimp harvester slowly climbed the road through the hills, but when it came to a pass where the road was entirely in shadow, it stopped.
"That's it," said Tantan, jumping from the cab. "That's as far as it will go, until dawn."
Matt helped him lift Chacho from the tank. They laid him next to the road wrapped in blankets Tantan had brought. He and Matt walked to the end of the pass and hunkered down, watching the sun slide into a violet haze. "How much farther is San Luis?" asked Matt.
3 miles, maybe 4, said Tantan. "We have to cross the Colorado River."
"I don't think Chacho can wait until morning." Tantan continued to gaze at the disappearing sun. It was hard to tell what was going through his mind.
I followed my parents into dreamland over there."
He pointed at the haze.
"Jorge saved me from the dogs. I thought he was wonderful, but he only thought I was stupid."
Tantan put his head down. Matt guessed he was crying, and he didn't want to embarrass him by noticing. "Something like that happened to me," Matt said at last.
"It did?"
said Tantan. "Someone I cared about more than anyone in the world tried to kill me."
"Wow," said Tantan. "That's really bad."
They said nothing for a while. Matt could hear Fidelito telling Chacho how much fun it was to camp out under the stars, and how he used to do it with his abuelita after the hurricane blew away their house.
"I guess you and Fidelito had better walk to San Luis," said Tantan. "If you could find a doctor, bring him here. If you haven't, returned by dawn, I'll go on."
Tantan gave Matt and Fidelito flashlights. He supplied them with blankets to ward off the cold, and lemons to survive the smell.
"The Colorado River's bad," he said. "It goes into a pipe before it gets to the road, but it's still dangerous. Stay away from it, Fidelito," he warned. "Pay attention or I'll,
beat the stuffing out of me,"
the little boy said cheerfully.
"I mean it this time," said Tantan.
Chapter 35. El Día de los Muertos. The walk downhill was easy, but Matt found he had to stop and rest frequently. He ached all over from his ordeal the night before, and some of his scratches were infected. He looked back to see Tantan watching gravely from shadows at the top of the pass. The snout of the shrimp harvester was just visible. Fidelito bounced up and down, waving the flashlight.
"Do you think he can see me?"
"I'm sure he can," said Matt. Sometimes Fidelito's energy made him feel tired. They went on, with Fidelito asking questions about who they were going to see. Matt told him about Maria and the convent of Santa Clara. He didn't know what the convent looked like, but he made up a description to entertain the little boy. "It's a castle on a hill," he said. "It has a tower with a red roof on each corner. Every morning the girls raise a flag in the garden."
"Like the keepers," said Fidelito.
"Yes," said Matt. Every morning the keepers lined up the boys and raised a flag with the emblem of a beehive over the factory. The boys recited the 5 principles of good citizenship and the 4 attitudes leading to right mindfulness before trooping into the cafeteria for plankton gruel. "This flag has a picture of the Virgin of Guadalupe. The girls sing Buenos Dias, Paloma Blanca, her favorite song, and then they have toast and honey for breakfast." Fidelito sighed. Matt wondered whether the keepers had managed to wake up from their drug sleep. Were they all lying dead like poor Furball? And would Tantan be arrested for murder? "Can the keepers get water in their compound?" he asked.
"Flaco said they could drink out of the toilet," said Fidelito.
"It's hard, but it's fair," Matt thought with a grim smile.
That smell is making me sick, said Fidelito.
Matt lifted his head. The stench had been growing so gradually he hadn't registered it. We must be close to the river, he said. He scratched the skin of a lemon and held it to Fidelito's nose. This won't kill the smell, but it should keep you from throwing up. Matt heard a gurgling, thrashing noise somewhere to the left and shone the flashlight at it. A wide black ribbon of water disappeared into a giant drain. It glistened with oil, and here and there, shapes struggled to the surface and were pulled down again.
Is that a fish?
Whispered Fidelito.
I don't think so,
Matt said, shining the light on a long, greasy-looking tentacle that whipped out of the flood and struggled wildly to hang on to the shore.
I think that's the reason Tantan told you to stay away from the river.
The tentacle lost the battle and disappeared down the drain with a horrible sucking sound.
Let's run,
begged the little boy. The ground trembled as the vast river plunged underneath the road. The smell almost made Matt faint.
Bad air,
he thought wildly. If they passed out here, no one would rescue them.
Faster,
Matt gasped. But in fact, it was he who was slow. Fidelito bounded ahead like a monkey. They went up a rise. A slight breeze blew the nauseous stench of the river away, and Matt collapsed with his chest heaving. He began to cough. He felt like he was being strangled.
Oh no, he thought. I can't have an asthma attack now.
He'd been free of the illness since he'd left opium, but the smell of the river had brought it back. He bent over, trying to fill his lungs. Fidelito frantically scratched his lemon and held it to Matt's nose.
Smell! Smell!
He cried, but it didn't help. Matt was drenched in sweat from his efforts to get air.
I'll go for help,
shouted Fidelito into his ear, as though Matt were deaf as well.
Stop! It's dangerous,
Matt wanted to say. But maybe it was just as well the little boy went on. There was nothing Matt could do to protect him. How much time passed, Matt couldn't say. The world had shrunk to a tiny patch of road where he struggled to stay alive. But all at once, he felt hands lift him, and an inhaler, held to his face. Matt grabbed it and breathed for all he was worth. The attack faded. The world began to expand again. He saw a brown, weathered face etched by deep wrinkles.
Look what the river coughed up, Guapo,
said the woman. Guapo, a name meaning handsome, hunkered by the side of the road and gave Matt a big, almost toothless grin. He was at least 80 years old.
The kid picked a lousy place to swim, he said.
I was joking,
said the woman.
Nobody swims in that river and survives. Can you walk?
She asked Matt. Matt got to his feet. He took a few unsteady steps and nodded.
Stay with us,
the woman said.
I don't suppose your mother's expecting you home tonight.
He's a runaway orphan. Look at his uniform, said Wapo.
You call those rags a uniform?
The woman laughed.
Don't worry, niño. We won't tell anyone. We hate the keepers as much as you do.
Chacho,
Matt gasped out.
The little one told us about him, said Wapo. Look, the ambulance is already on its way.
He pointed up, and Matt saw a hovercraft pass overhead. The anti-gravity stirred the hair on his arms. With Wapo on one side, and the woman, who identified herself as his sister Consuela, on the other, Matt made his way along the road. He felt lightheaded. Everything seemed unreal. The dark road, the starry sky, and the old man and woman who guided his steps. Presently, they came to a high wall. Consuela pressed a button, and a door slid open to show a scene so unexpected Matt wondered whether he was dreaming after all. Inside, flanked by graceful Palo Verde trees, were graves, as far as Matt could see. Each one was decorated with palm fronds, flowers, photographs, statues, and hundreds of glittering candles. The candles sat in red, blue, green, yellow, and purple glasses, and looked like fragments of rainbow dancing over the ground. Some of the graves had offerings of food as well. Tortillas, bowls of chili, bottles of soda, fruit, and whole herds of tiny donkeys, horses, and pigs made out of pastry or sugar. On one grave was a beautiful little cat with a pink sugar nose and a tail curled around its feet. Matt saw people sitting in the shadows and speaking to one another in quiet voices. "Where are we?" he murmured.
"A cemetery, chico," said Consuela. "Don't tell me you've never seen one."
Not like this, Matt thought. The Alacrangs were buried in a marble mausoleum not far from the hospital. It was the size of a house, and decorated with so many angels it looked like a convention of them. You could see through the front door to what appeared to be chests of drawers on either side. The name of a departed Alacrang was inscribed on each long drawer. Matt guessed you could slide them out like the ones in his room, where Celia packed his shirts and socks. The Egypts, of course, were buried in mass graves out in the desert. Tamlin said their resting places were impossible to distinguish from landfill. "This looks like a party," Matt faltered.
"It is!"
cried Fidelito, suddenly appearing from amid a group of women who were unpacking picnic baskets.
"We're so lucky. Of all the days we could have come, we picked el Día de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. It's my favorite holiday in the whole year."
He munched on a sandwich. Matt couldn't understand it. Celia had celebrated every holiday on the calendar, but never had she mentioned this one. She put out shoes for the wise men to leave gifts at Christmas. She colored eggs for Easter. She served roast turkey on Thanksgiving and heart-shaped cakes on St. Valentine's Day. She had special ceremonies for San Mateo, Matt's patron saint, and for her own Santa Cecilia. And of course, there was El Patron's birthday party. But never, never, never had anyone dreamed of throwing a party for death. Yet here Matt saw, on grave after grave, statues of skeletons playing guitars or dancing or driving around in little plastic hover cars. Skeleton mothers took skeleton children for walks. Skeleton brides married skeleton grooms. Skeleton dogs sniffed lampposts. And skeleton horses galloped with death riding on their backs. And now, Matt became aware of an odor. The foul stench of the river was kept away by the wall, but the air was full of another scent that made every nerve in Matt's body tighten with alarm. It smelled like Felicia. It was as though her ghost hovered before him, breathing the heavy fumes of whiskey into his face. He sat down, suddenly dizzy.
"Are you sick?"
asked Fidelito.
"Guapo, find another inhaler in my bag," said Consuela.
"No, no, I'm all right," said Matt. "The smell here reminded me of something."
"It's only the copal incense we burn for the dead,"
Consuela said.
"Maybe it reminds you of your mama or papa. But you mustn't be unhappy. Tonight is when we welcome them back, to let them see how we're doing, and to offer them their favorite foods."
"They eat?" Matt looked at the tamales, bowls of chili, and loaves of bread decorated with pink sugar.
"Not as we do, darling. They like to smell things," said Consuela. "That's why we serve so many foods with a good odor."
"Mi abuelita said they come back as doves or mice. She said I mustn't chase anything away if it wants to eat," said Fidelito.
"That's also true," said Consuela, putting her arm around the little boy.
Matt thought about the Alacrangs in their marble mausoleum. Perhaps El Patron was there. In the top drawer, of course. Then Matt remembered Celia saying El Patron wanted to be buried in an underground storeroom with all his birthday presents. Was anyone putting out food for him tonight? Had Celia prepared tamales and bowls of menudo? But Celia was hiding in the stables, and Mr. Alacrán wouldn't put out so much as a single chili bean because he hated El Patron. Matt blinked away tears. How can anyone celebrate death?
"Because it's part of us," Consuela said softly.
"Mi abuelita said I mustn't be afraid of skeletons because I carry my own around inside," said Fidelito. "She told me to feel my ribs and make friends with them."
"Your grandmother was very wise," said Consuela.
"I'm off to town now for the fiesta," said Wapo,
who put on a handsome black sombrero and slung a guitar over his shoulder.
"Do you kids want me to drop you off anywhere?"
Consuela laughed.
"You old rogue, you only want to chase women."
I don't have to chase anyone, the old man replied haughtily.
Come home in one piece, Wapito. I worry about you.
She kissed him and straightened the sombrero on his head.
What about you, kids? Shall I take you to see Chacho? He's in the hospital at the convent of Santa Clara.
That's where we were going,
Fidelito cried. What about the keepers? Matt said.
They stay off the streets when there's a party. Too much fun, said Consuela. But just in case.
She fished around in her large bag and brought out a pair of masks.
I was saving these for my grandchildren, but I'll get them something else.
She fitted a mask over Fidelito's face. Matt felt a strange tightening in his chest when he saw the skull staring back at him from Fidelito's skinny body.
Put yours on, too,
urged the little boy. Matt couldn't move. He couldn't take his eyes off Fidelito's face.
I've got one of my own, said Wapple, slipping on his mask.
That's an improvement, believe me, said Consuela.
Wapo capered around, his black sombrero bobbing over his skull face. Matt knew they were trying to cheer him up, but he felt only horror.
Listen, mi vida, said Consuela.
Matt flinched at the sound of his old name.
I don't know what bad things happened to you, but it's a matter of safety to wear the mask now. The keepers won't bother you if you're wearing a costume.
Matt saw the wisdom of her suggestion. Very reluctantly, he pulled the mask over his head. It fitted him like a second skin, with holes for his eyes, nose, and mouth. It felt like being buried alive, and he had to struggle against panic. He took a deep breath and willed the horror away. Muchas gracias, he said.
De nada,
Consuela replied. Chapter 36 The Castle on the Hill. As he followed Wapple, Matt noticed that all the graves were dotted with golden flowers. When they reached the road, he saw a trail of their bright petals leading from the cemetery. What's that? He whispered to Fidelito.
Cempasúchil flowers. For the dead to find their way back home.
Matt couldn't help feeling a chill as they trod the delicate petals into the dust. The old man had a small personal hover car, and it took a while for him to coax it into the air. Even then, it hovered only a few feet off the ground.
Cheap antigrav, muttered Guapo, fussing with dials and buttons. I got it at a discount. I'm sure it's mixed with electrons.
The car left the graveyard behind and came to the first houses. All had paths of flowers to their doors. What struck Matt was how beautiful the houses were. They didn't look at all like the hovels he'd seen on TV. They were made of a shining material molded into fantastic shapes. Some were like small castles, while others looked like ships or space stations, and still others grew like trees, with fanciful balconies and rooftop gardens. As Wapo's hover car went by, holographic displays were triggered in the yards. Skeletons zoomed around on rockets. A skeleton wedding, complete with priest and flower girls, marched across a lawn. Fidelito leaned out the window and tried to touch them. In the distance, Matt heard music and the sputter of fireworks. Fidelito pointed at a shower of red and green sparks in the sky. Soon, the road became crowded with bands of partygoers until Wapo could hardly move at all. In a good hover car, he could have soared over people's heads. The best he could manage was to blare his horn and push his way through the mob. There was so much music and shouting, no one paid attention to the horn. Matt watched the stream of people in wonder. In all his life, he'd never seen so many. They sang and danced. They hoisted children onto their shoulders to see the fireworks painting the skies. They playfully rocked the hover car until Wapo yelled at them. And the costumes! Gorillas, cowboys, and astronauts mobbed the food stalls. Zorro cracked his whip at a trio of space aliens ahead of him in line. La Llorona and the Chupacabras waltzed by with bottles of beer. But most of the people were dressed like skeletons. Matt grabbed Wapple's shoulder and cried, "Who's that?" The old man glanced at the figure in a black and silver suit.
"Him? That's only the vampire of Dreamland."
And Matt saw a line of brown-clad, skull-faced Egypts shuffling after a terrifyingly real El Patron. Matt shrank into his seat. He had to breathe deeply to overcome his shock. He felt a wrenching sense of loss, which didn't make any sense at all. If El Patron had lived, he, Matt, would be dead.
Keepers,
whispered Fidelito. Matt saw the group of men standing by the side of the road. They scowled at the revelers as if to say, all of you are drones, and when winter comes, the worker bees will throw you into the snow to die.
I'm going to show them the map of the world,
announced Fidelito, but Matt grabbed him and held him down.
You kids stop wrestling back there, said Wapo. You're making the magnetic coils overheat.
At last, they passed through the seething fiesta. The carnival booths fell behind. The smell of fried meat and beer died away, and they came to the base of a hill. Above them wound a lovely and peaceful lane lined with pomegranate trees. At intervals, globes of burning gas cast a white-hot light over the ground.
The hover car can't make it up there, said Wapo. But it isn't far to the top. Give my best to the sisters at the hospital. They stitched me up after the last fiesta and threw in a free lecture to boot.
The old man gave Matt a wolfish grin. Matt was sorry to see him go. He hadn't known Wapo and Consuela long, but he liked them very much. He removed his mask and helped Fidelito do the same.
Is that where Maria lives?
Asked the little boy, craning his neck to see the top of the hill. Matt's heart sank. He desperately wanted to find Maria. He'd been thinking of little else for weeks. But would she want to see him? Hadn't she merely befriended him out of pity? Matt knew he'd been quite literally an underdog, and Maria couldn't resist a crusade. At least he'd been an appealing underdog then. Now his face was covered with acne. His body was scarred with welts from Jorge's cane, as well as sores from the scratches he got in the boneyard. His clothes were filthy. He reeked of rotten shrimp. Would Maria be so embarrassed by his appearance that she'd slam the door in his face? That's where she lives, he told Fidelito.
I wonder if they're having a party, said Fidelito.
Me too, thought Matt, as they started up the steep hill. He imagined the convent girls dressed in fine clothes, like the bridesmaids at Emilia's wedding. He combed his hair with his fingers and felt the heavy coating of sand and salt. If Fidelito was anything to go by, and the little boy was at least cute, in a basic sort of way, the two of them were as attractive as a pair of mangy coyotes.
It is a castle,
said Fidelito in awe. The white walls and towers of the convent of Santa Clara rose out of bougainvillea hedges, dense with violet and crimson flowers. The same bright lights that bordered the winding path hung in the air over the walls. The building was made of the same shining substance as the houses in San Luis. Matt didn't know what it was, but it shimmered like silk.
They have toast and honey for breakfast,
murmured Fidelito.
I wonder if they'll give us some.
First we have to find the door, said Matt. They followed a flagstone path around the building. It showed them windows high on the walls, but no doors. This has to go somewhere, Matt said. At that instant, lights came on and the wall opened, as though someone had drawn aside a curtain. They saw an archway leading to a lighted courtyard. Matt took a deep breath and put his hand on Fidelito's shoulder. The little boy was trembling.
Is it magic?
He whispered. A hologram, said Matt. It's part of the security system. It makes the wall look solid from a distance, but once you get beyond the projectors, he pointed at the cameras in the trees, the hologram goes away.
Is it okay? I mean, if it turns on again, will we be trapped inside?
Matt smiled. It's perfectly safe. I've seen this before where I used to live. Fidelito looked up at him.
Was that when you were a zombie?
Oh, brother, Matt said. Don't tell me you believed Jorge's lies.
Of course not,
said the little boy, but Matt noticed he seemed relieved. Matt led Fidelito through the archway and past a white marble statue of St. Francis feeding the doves. On the far side, they came to a hallway. Nurses and orderlies ran here and there with bandages and medicines. The beds lining the hallway were full of injured people, and because most of the people were in costume, it looked like the beds were occupied by skeletons.
What are you doing here?
Cried a flustered nurse, bumping into the two boys.
Please, we came to see Chacho, said Matt.
And Maria,
added Fidelito.
There's 100 Marias in here tonight, said the nurse. It happens every year with that cursed fiesta. All those people drinking and picking fights.